You are seeing me on probably more sleep than I've had in almost a year. So that could be good or bad, maybe too much. So it's really exciting and interesting for me to be here with you all. It's also my first trip to Dallas outside of the airport. So that's educational for me as well. I wanted to mention that I've uploaded the latest version of my presentation at this address here, so you can get that later. And there's also an address at the end that I'll show you where you can probably always keep my updated stuff. So I'll come to that later when it's more interesting. Okay. Also, in addition to being Buddhist, I'm also Jewish, and so it's really hard for me to talk while one of my hands is occupied. So I'm only half talking. It's hard. So you all are communicators. Who are you talking to? You probably think a lot about who your audience is. So this is a line from Jay Rosen, who's a journalism professor at NYU, who's been on the forefront of understanding blogs and blog culture and the traditional media and their evolution or lack thereof in the new media landscape. His point here is to say, stop thinking about yourself as, you know, a fire hose or a one-way conduit of information, and start thinking about yourself as part of a community. People expect to engage with your content, to participate, and they don't want to be told what to do. You can follow him on Twitter. Oh, I forgot. I did this last night, and I apologize for those of you who were here last night, because this is going to be somewhat repetitive, but not exactly the same. And if you get bored, you can, like, look for a little bit that I changed since last night. But there's also new things I did since last night. So I know a lot of you, because especially you are the communicators, so a lot of you are doing more stuff online and things like that. How many of you are using Twitter? A lot of you. It's really cool. And I think you're almost all using blogs, right? Sort of, even if you don't update them very often, right? And probably Facebook and stuff like that. What are some of the other online communities or social networks that y'all participate in? Does anybody do MySpace these days? Yeah? Gavin's doing it. What are some of the other ones?
LinkedIn.
Oh, yeah, LinkedIn. That's interesting. I never know whether LinkedIn is the place to go for certain things that aren't directly like professional networking, but more and more people are using it for other stuff.
I use Yelp a lot for reference.
Uh-huh.
Yelp. But it occurred to me, I wonder if houses of worship are reviewed.
They are.
Yeah, I assume they are. And I need to look for that. So that'd be nice to see.
That's a really smart place to be.
I got to tell you, my local church, we're in a neighborhood with a lot of young people, and I lead a group of newcomers to welcome them. And the last three people in my group, they found the church on Yelp.
Wow.
So we ask our members to review the church and give testimonies on there, and they're generally pretty positive.
I think that is just really, really smart. Very good thing. So that's Yelp.com. Excuse me. I've noticed that Yelp has been really trying to expand and grow a lot into different areas and things. So, you know what else? Anyone use Foursquare? I know some of you all personally do, because we all checked in at the hotel last night. Right? But that's another thing where, because Foursquare is location-based, that might also be another place to, like, make sure your church is on Foursquare so people can check in when they go to services. But anyway, okay. So I don't want to get all hung up on particular. I just thought of that just now. I don't really like to get hung up on particular technologies and platforms. What I'm going to talk about more is the strategy for using them. So don't think of the people you're talking to as this crate full of lifeless eyeballs that are just going to sit there and consume your information, right? Because that's not what people want to be. This new media landscape. It didn't just pop right out of the blue. In fact, it's been brewing for a while. This book was one example of the writing on the wall. It was written over 10 years ago, and it's called The Clue Train Manifesto. It was written by folks who were doing marketing, and they really were not pleased with the direction of online marketing because they felt like it was about as engaging as print marketing, which was to say not very much. And so just like Jay Rosen said about journalism, they said about customers, in this case, people were not eyeballs. We're not just going to sit here. And we don't want you to just preach at us. We want to talk back to you. We want to participate. We want you to listen to us. That's their quote from the top. We're not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers or people. So increasingly, again, we need to think about this as an ecosystem that we're all participating in. And as you all know, things are changing. That's why you're here. I also wanted to mention, too, one of the things that a few folks mentioned last night that I also saw some of y'all tweeting about last night afterward was the question of sort of whether, you know, is this the new direction you have to go in and, you know, forget the old print newsletter. Nobody wants to read that anymore. Now you just have to be on Twitter. I'm not saying that. In fact, it takes all kinds. And the people, you know, people formerly known as your audience, some of them still are your audience, too, right? They're still there. They still want to get your newsletter, too. So I'm not saying that you should throw that in the bin. But it is a new landscape. The internet has changed the terms. And in addition to that, now we have these kids who are being called by some demographers, they call them millennials. Conveniently for me, the Pew Center for the Study of the Internet has recently done a study all about millennials. And they've defined them as people who are currently teenagers to 30 years old. That's sort of an open demographic. It could stay open longer. So people who are 10 right now may turn out to be considered classified as part of the millennial generation. So I know y'all are really interested in, you know, I'm not an expert in youth culture, but I know you're really interested in figuring out how to bring in these new audiences and how to talk. Oh, look, I just used every audience. How to talk to younger people and people who have sort of who come from a different culture. Another interesting thing is that if you go to the Pew website right now on this millennial study, I have the URL on the next page. Of course, you don't have to write them down because you can download the whole presentation. But they have a little game you can play or a quiz to see how millennial are you, right? And it asks you different things like how much TV you watch, do you have a tattoo? I can't remember the other stuff. But, of course, I and my colleagues all ended up being, and, you know, we're all well over 30, we all ended up being more millennial than an average millennial. The reason I'm saying that is because in some ways this may be about talking to younger people, but in other ways it's really just about talking to this to a different culture. And it's not necessarily age-based. So again, by some classifications, you might consider me more millennial. I'm almost 40. Right, so it's really how you talk to people who are digital natives or who have these assumptions about how communication should work, partially because of the internet. So some of the things that Pew found about this millennial generation are that this is a U.S. specific, so that they're more ethnically diverse than the average U.S. population, that they're generally less religious, they're less likely to have served in the military, but they're more likely to have gotten a lot more schooling, and that's partially because they're coming of age during this economy when they can't get jobs. So a lot of people, more people are going back to school. So here's a few boring charts also from the study. First of all, who's online? On the left, it's not just young people, obviously, but disproportionately so. Nearly all young people are online. But note that adults over 65, almost 40% are online. Of my two grandmothers, who are both over 90, one of them is online, 50% of my sample. So don't write them off. And when you think of, you know, your website, it's not just, you don't want to make it all MySpace just for the teenagers, right? Because there are still, you know, your older, more established participants and donors and people who want to use your website too. And social networking sites, also not just for the kids. Lower penetration for people over 30, but a lot of people are still there. And then over here in the corner, we have the number of adults who use Twitter or something Twitter-like with updating status. And I'm not sure exactly how Pew defined that, but probably includes Facebook and things like that. It's difficult to see that. But again, all adults, 19%. 18 to 24 is 37%, so about twice as many. Of your under 25 set are doing it, but a very significant proportion of people who are online are using this stuff. Not everybody's online. You still have to talk to those people too, but I'm not an expert in those ones. Next year you can have somebody who's a genius in print publication, like my boss or something. So are you reaching out to people in all these different places? Another thing that we really often forget is that people aren't just sitting at a computer when they go online. They might be sitting at a gaming console, like a Wii or an Xbox. They might be sitting at their phone, very likely, right? Or a portable gaming device or something else that we haven't thought of yet. So, you know, when they're going online from wherever that is, do you have stuff for them there? If you're on PlayStation, there's a PlayStation Network, and you can have friends and stuff in the PlayStation Network. Do you have content there for them? Are there games, like there are games, one I'm familiar with is Little Big Planet that's on PlayStation, where you can make levels or games that people play in it. You could make one that's, you know, like a church game that folks could come and play, right? That's a different way for people to engage with your stuff, and it might be really interesting to some different people. So does everybody need to go, should you all run out and go get a Wii and make your, you know, your little church, they're called Mii's on your Wii? I'm going to say no. Experts say no, like a Family Feud. This was a Pew-related study with also Elon University, which is in North Carolina. It does a lot of surveys and things like that. And they talk to these sort of authoritative experts, however they define that, and ask them about what did they think the internet was going to be like in 2020. And this, you know, predicting the future, right, is kind of fraught. But some of the interesting things I thought from this study, some of these nuggets were, one, that they said that, you know, what's the next big thing? You know, Twitter became big about in late 2006 is when it sort of took off. Or actually, it's 2007 at South by Southwest, but it was started earlier than that. And now it's the thing, right? And all the celebrities are there, and CNN is on Twitter, and so whatever. That's the thing where you have to be, right? But it wasn't 3 years ago, and it won't be 3 years from now. So in 2020, we don't know what the gadget's going to be. So you don't want to pour all your money into your Wii presents, you know, or your Xbox game. Shock. You do need to think about, you know, being in some different places, and you need to think about, that's one of the reasons to have your information and stuff be open, because that makes it, the more portable your content and your community is, the better, the more it can go to those places. And I thought also, as people who are communicating a lot, you all might be interested to see that they said that Google won't make us stupid. Hopefully, the more information aspect of being able to find supposedly anything online will hopefully outweigh our laziness in not having to look very hard for it anymore. And also that reading doesn't go away. The internet will enhance reading and writing and the rendering of knowledge, they said. And one of the things I said last night someone picked up on was, it doesn't say that print publications are going to be improved or still around, or that, you know, the news media is going to be sustained by this. Not necessarily, right? We hope that there is some form of news media, especially journalism, in the future. But what form will it take? We don't really know. And as an industry, big picture, I think that journalism is really only starting to grasp with the implications of this change. And so there are some new models that people are trying. There's like citizen journalism. There's CNN being all over Twitter, stuff like that. But you know, we really don't know if any of these things are going to work. What's going to replace journalism? Maybe we'll see in the future more of those old-fashioned papers where papers didn't used to pretend to be objective, right? Like, which is a joke anyway, right? But in the old days, you weren't supposed to. You know, newspapers didn't do that. They didn't lend to their credibility. You know, they were completely opinionated. And I think having opinions is one of the motivations for people to publish and to share information. Maybe that's what will drive more journalism in the future, for example. And that makes it more blog-like. It's sort of like blogs and journalism converging. Who knows? So very interesting and a fun website there, too. elon.edu/predictions. So given that we have no idea what's going to happen in the future, and especially in terms of print, what's going to happen in the future, How do we deal with this? My approach is to think about, instead of thinking about an audience and these people that you're broadcasting at, is to think about networks. Think about yourself as part of a network. Think about growing a network. And, of course, that lends itself to social networks. But social networks aren't just your Facebook, folks, although that's certainly part of your social network. Everybody knows that. Social networks are actual networks of people. They're relationships, which I'll talk about later. So social networks didn't come up with the internet. They're not going to go away with that. And also, when I talk about this network-based strategy, it doesn't just mean online. The internet is a network of networks, and it lends itself to this type of thing, but this isn't a strategy just for the internet. This is a strategy for communication in general. So people are making their own networks and things like that, but remember, they don't want to be eyeballs. They don't want to be told what to do, but people do still like to do things together. That's the reason that they do go on Facebook and get their groups of friends together. Whether you go on there to play a game or to share information, a lot of people are building these communities online because they want to do things together still. There is power in doing that. What you want to figure out is how to empower those folks that are your network to be effective communicators of the information that you're trying to spread or of their information too, right? Because you're listening to them. Maybe what you need to do is make sure you're hearing from them more too as part of your network. So I talked last night about, I'm sorry, that's very difficult to read. down here it says, how do you make a network into a swarm? A swarm is when, say, there's a hive of bees who all are doing one thing singularly, but without someone saying, hey, everybody do this. Although bees do kind of communicate with each other. But you'll often see this happen on blogs where a story will just break out on one blog, all the other bloggers that read it pick it up, and so on and so on and so on until it's a huge storm. And then the media is forced to respond to things and it becomes a real story. Is it real only when the media gets it? I don't know. But that's an example of a swarm where you already have a connected network of bloggers and an idea or an action is spreading through it in a leaderless fashion. Now, I know that can be a difficult cultural shift, but that's exactly what this is about. Again, it's not just about using the internet. This really is a change in thinking about your communities and to think of folks as a community together instead of as a top-down. I understand it's inherent in the structure of churches and things like that. And it fortunately can exist in parallel with your existing structure. But increasingly, I think you want to do this more and more. It's otherwise, people will find it less and less relevant, whatever you're doing. So some people call this Web 2.0. Web 1.0 is when you would read a web page, and then you read it, and you were done. Web 2.0 is when you read a web page, and then you write a comment about what a good or bad idea it is that you've just read, and then you post a link to the web page to Twitter, and then one of your friends replies and said, oh, you know, I read that article last week, and I found this other thing that's even better, and so on. Okay, so instead of just receiving the information passively, people are engaging with it, and again, there's an expectation for people to do this. These are all other words that I think get at the same concept, but they may help you think of it in a different way. Network-centric advocacy comes from studies of network-centric warfare, grassroots warfare that's less based on like, tanks and stuff like that. User-generated is what the marketing people like to call it about 5 years ago, 10 years ago. People-powered is what Howard Dean's campaign called it. Bottom-up social marketing, and I like to think of it also as grassroots organizing because I came up learning organizing models and how to connect people to each other and build movements that way. All right, I'm going to start going a little bit faster. So, finally, to the nut, I'm going to talk about these five things that make networks function effectively, again, to do the swarming or to connect people together to act effectively as more of a movement instead of just talking to people in one direction. So first, strong social ties. This can mean personal relationships or professional relationships sometimes. People, there needs to be trust in the network because if you tweet a link out and I don't trust you or I think you're crazy, then I'm not going to pass that on to anybody else because I don't trust your thinking about that. We also have to be aware of each other. There are people on Twitter who are completely brilliant, but if I don't know about them, I can't even follow them. So part of the network is being aware of who's out there and who's in it. So these are some of my networks of with my personal relationships, but these are also some more of my networks. Okay, and they're not exclusive. Some of these people are these people too. Okay, so you shouldn't even think about online versus offline. You're just doing network building. Let's see. And I don't know if you all have ever seen this, but there's a field, actually academically, since the 70s, called social network analysis, and it's really neat, and people actually draw maps of social networks. So these are some examples of maps of networks. Each one of these lines is a relationship. That's the thing to think about when you think of these maps, and I'm going to talk about network structures. You just want to think about every line as a relationship. Now, this might not be a personal social network. This could be a professional network. A lot of people use social network analysis to help corporations. Like, if you have two companies that are merging, they'll, like, map them out and figure out who are the gatekeepers and who are the influential people in different companies and things like that. This one up here is from part of my, it's a section of my Facebook network, but not the whole thing or anything. But I can see there, right, there's clusters of people who all tend to know each other. But there's a few separate clusters in my life. You know, maybe there's the people from the nonprofit technology community. There's people that I know in Chapel Hill. Who are some of these people? Some people from like sort of the political world, things like that. And interesting, this guy seems to be really interesting because he touches more of my different communities, right? Like most of my friends just know people in the clump that they're in, but he knows people in all my different clumps. That's really interesting, right? So start thinking about that network mapping. So, for people to use your network, they need to know each other. That can be facilitated by in-person connections and online. Another thing that ties people together is having a common story. It doesn't mean literally a story from a book like this guy is reading, but having common experiences and using common language. That's something that that you definitely have in the church, where you can quote from the Bible, and it's something that everybody knows what you're talking about right away, right? That's very powerful. It's something that ties you together, makes you very effective. If I wrote an article in your newsletter, I would use different language, and it would not resonate with people. They would not know what I was talking about. It might be educational for other reasons, but it wouldn't build ties and build connections by reading with outsider perspective. So here's an example from wonderful American Friends Service Committee, a really, really great organization. They did this campaign called Friends for Peace several years ago, and they encouraged people to download these little signs and put their own identities on it. So they're making, you know, what they're doing here is they're forming one message for peace, but with each individual voice. I gave another example last night of, you know, where I used my husband and I to talk about an example about birth control, because I wanted people to see married couples use birth control. That was the point I wanted to make. So here, people want to make the point. Grandmas are for peace. U.S. Navy veterans are for peace. Poodles, apparently, are for peace also. Well, probably poodle owners are for peace, right? But it's so much more effective than, like, a list of 5 or 100 or 1,000 names or, you know, email petitions. It's like real people showing their real who they are and coming together around the one message of being for peace. Another example of forming the common story, this website Dig. I'm not saying you should use Dig in particular, but it's an example of where a bunch of people are working together to say, I think this is important, I think this is not important, thumbs up or thumbs down, and then you get the collective thumbs up, where they as a group have edited the news, basically. And so you get a sense of what the hive thinks is important in this case. And it's a disproportionately geeky group of people using Dig. But again, that's that particular site. But it's a way to sort of surface what are the things that everybody thinks are important. We also talked last night in some of the discussion about comments and sort of how to deal with poor quality comments and argumentative comments and things that you might get. And this is another example of where you can use your community to say, well, actually, we think this is a good comment. Actually, a lot of us think this is a bad comment. And you can literally elevate or put away stuff that people don't like. So again, on Dig, when things get a lot of digs or a thumbs up, they literally rise to the surface and rise to the front page. Okay, this next example is a little crazy. Y'all remember the State of the Union address last year? This guy, Joe Wilson, he's from South Carolina, not North Carolina, I think. Yes. And so he shouted out during the State of the Union address, "You lie," during the president's talk. So what? Well, this was an experience that, you know, an experience that was shared by many, many people. Many, many people either felt very good or very bad about it. It happened out of the blue, could not be planned for. But because networks were in place to fundraise, it caused a vast number of donations for both sides, right? A lot of people on the left saw this and were angry, could not believe the disrespect that people were showing to the president. And they went and figured out, well, does this guy have an opponent? Never heard of Joe Wilson. You sure didn't know, like, is he running against someone? But turns out he was. This guy, Rob Miller, has a page on ActBlue, which is a fundraising site. So people found it, spread it all around Twitter and stuff. In the middle there in the green were the trending topics on Twitter just after this. So one of them was Joe Wilson, and another one was the president, and another one is You Lie. Okay, so this lit up all over Twitter. Again, pro and con. So again, some people were spreading it around. You know, you think Joe Wilson stinks, go give to this guy, Rob Miller. Or you think Joe Wilson's awesome, we need some more of that, go give to Joe Wilson. So it says here, Miller raised, in the week after, he raised $1.5 million, three times what he had raised in 2008. And Wilson raised even more. So from his outburst, this guy, Joe Wilson, raised nearly $2 million after that because it was an internet sensation. Also, Democratic National Committee capitalized on it, raised $1 million the day after. So you need to have the networks in place beforehand. But this is also an example of a common story, two different common stories. One story was, oh my God, that's outrageous, and the other story was, oh my God, that's great. And another example of being ready for this kind of thing is natural disasters. Uh-huh. We've seen increasingly huge amounts of fundraising and other types of support that's been mobilized. After the Haiti earthquake, definitely there was tons of texting and stuff. But if you actually remember the Indonesian tsunami about 3 or 4 years ago, that was one of the first times that people that really saw like blogs mobilize. And they were mobilizing not just for donations, but also to get information out. And again, you couldn't just say, oh, this terrible thing happened, I better go set up a blog with information about it. Too late. You need to have the blog in place. You need to have the infrastructure and the network in place so that when these things happen, you're ready for it. And by the way, all of my examples, I usually illustrate 3 or 4 or 5 of these different things, so they're not just talking about one thing. So the third thing is a dense communication grid, sort of like a city street network. Not really like in Dallas where it's a little sprawly, but maybe downtown. Again, you want to think about giving people multiple opportunities to meet, find each other, and to connect to each other, both online and offline, both on Facebook and at weekly meetings or annual conferences or things like that, or monthly phone conference calls where people can talk to each other, you know, hear each other's stories, learn what's going on, things like that. You know, the analogy, I think about this kind of stuff a lot because I'm also like an amateur urban planner. And if you think about a cul-de-sac or a network of cul-de-sacs versus a grid network, if something happens that closes off one of those, like a tree falls down across your street or something else, there's a flood or anything, you could be completely trapped if you're on a cul-de-sac. But if that were to happen in a grid network, you would just go around. And that's why it's so robust. There's lots of ways to go. And when you think of people's connections to each other, there's lots of ways for people to connect to each other. So some people are better in person. Some people would rather do an email, too. Or maybe if we meet up once at a social, then I'm more likely to email you later, which I wouldn't have done before. So one example of building and reinforcing these connections is the blog Daily Coast, which started out as one guy's and his friend's political stuff. Marcos Moulitsas, who's a big Democratic activist. And after a while, Daily Coast quickly grew into a huge community, partially just because he was there first. And they started having annual conferences. So what we see on the bottom left is an aggregator, called Technorati, where it's pulling together things that are mentioning Daily Coast, or in this case, I actually did a search for things that were mentioning the conference, networks pulling those together. Here's actual people in person at the conference. It's a Native American interest group that met up at the conference. They're forming some very strong bonds to each other, right? They may see each other on the blog every day, and they don't know who each other are, but now they've met up. They have this solidarity group with this cluster of Native Americans, and they've got this really strong attachment to each other within this network, identified with this network. And up on the top right, that's actually a picture from Second Life, which was the it thing 2 years ago, right? Everybody gotta have a house in Second Life or something. People don't talk about it anymore, and some people are like, oh, that's all over. But it still has as much activity as it had 2 years ago. It's just no one's interested. It's just still there. It's not doing something new and exciting. It's not exploding with its growth anymore. And it's not that everybody needs to be there, but some people definitely should. For example, disability communities are really, really interested in Second Life because people can have an experience. In Second Life, each of these little people there is an avatar. Not unlike the movie Avatar, but long predating it. And that's a real person there. But they can make their avatar in Second Life look however they want. So maybe you want to experience being able-bodied, or maybe you don't. Because I've met people in Second Life who intentionally put their avatar in a wheelchair to make people more aware of that. Maybe you want to try being a different gender or a different race or taller of purple-hued skin or pink hair or whatever it is. People do it. This gal here has some ears. You see a lot weirder stuff than that in Second Life, for sure. But anyway, those folks in Second Life are having yearly coasts in Second Life, okay? Because not everybody can afford to go to a conference and travel and whatnot, or maybe they don't care to. But from wherever they are, they're going, and they're also forming connections and relationships and getting to know each other. For a while, I facilitated a weekly meeting in Second Life of sort of progressive online activists. And, we would meet up each week and learn about what each other were doing. And we learn more and more about each other. We get to know each other. So even though that group's not meeting anymore, if I go to Second Life and there's some folks are organizing a Don't Bomb Iran protest, which some folks did last year, some of the people who were doing it, I already knew them because I had a relationship with them from having our weekly meetings before. And that allowed me to trust them and say, okay, these people know what they're doing. Or some of the folks I didn't know, and I was a little more hesitant about getting involved. So all these, and then these things feed back in, right? Because then these people have solidified their relationship to that Daily Coast community, and so they're going to come back to the blog more, and they're going to comment more, and so on and so on and so on. Another example of different ways of getting your information out and the connections in different ways are through feeds. This could be formally what RSS feeds, but in this example, we're seeing feeds from all kinds of things. Does anyone think there's something weird about that one on the left? Harry and Voldemort set their relationship to mortal enemies. That's a joke. Mm-hmm. That one on the left. Facebook actually made that. It was like probably an April 1st thing or something, but it's a parody they made of themselves. But this big thing on the right, this is from a site called FriendFeed that you can use to pull in all your different feeds. Another interesting thing to think about, and I was going to talk about this with Second Life too, is identity in networks. People really want to, part of engaging in a network is identifying yourself, because you're one of those nodes. If you think about that network map, you're a node in there, and then you're connecting to all these different people, so you have to define what you are so that you can say what it is that's connected to someone else. Like on Facebook, it's your profile that's connected to someone else, and you define your profile. You put as much or as little information as you want there. You put an actual picture of yourself, or you put a picture of a beach ball, right? You define what that identity is. So here, FriendFeed is one of many services that allow you to sort of aggregate your online identity. And this is a list of all the feeds that they can suck into the service for you. It's kind of amazing. On the right, this one that says My Services, that's just the ones that I was using. I mentioned earlier about having information be open so people can pull it in different ways. So this is another example of where people want their stuff to flow around. This is more based on a person, but RSS feeds, which every blog generates automatically, wonderfully, make it really easy for folks to pull in information, both for a personal aggregator, like maybe when I go to my iGoogle page, my homepage could have a feed of the latest from your blog, but also that can be, you can use a public aggregator. So if you have a local church website that's part of a statewide network or a conference, maybe the conference puts out a feed that all the different churches can use and have a little widget on their page, right? And they can all be sucking that information in. So information wants to be free. Standardized formats make it easier, and open formats make it easier for people to share it. Here's my network structures, my social network analysis page. These are all different networks. They could be of people. They can also be of institutions and things like that. There's a real tendency when people talk about social network analysis to start thinking about groups and their relationships to each other, but don't do that because the same principles often don't apply when they're relationships between institutions. It's really, really, really about relationships between people. So hierarchical, we're all very familiar with that. The star or hub spoke sort of structure, a ring. Now this one here, this tree, you'll notice that not only is it like the star but multiplied, it's actually the same thing as a hierarchical network, except instead of being on the top, that same node or dot is in the center. It's actually the same map, right? So that really illustrates the difference between thinking about things in a linear top-down fashion versus in a network fashion. And of course, on the bottom left is the mesh network. That's the one we love. That's our redundant street network, right? Where, like, if we've got a committee that's working on stuff, if one person on the committee stops doing stuff, if it's this person, forget it. You've got a major functional problem. But if it's this person that stops doing things, not as much of an issue, right? People still have the connections. So you really want to think about weaving networks together. Like, do you know people in your church or in your conference who would be really interested in what each other are doing, or one of them has skills or resources the other one would like? You need to weave that connection between them so that you're not the bottleneck between them, but you connect them to each other. Okay, so that's the redundant network, giving people lots of opportunities and ways to connect to each other. Number four is sharing resources. This is my favorite part of internet culture, probably, is this ethic of sharing things. But it has downsides, of course. We talked last night about sort of the music industry, right? And how at first people still do, and I admit I'm one of those internet people who feels entitled to get anything for free all the time. Like, you know, I've been trying to download ebooks for my phone recently, and I'm really annoyed that I can't find, like, the latest Margaret Atwood novel for free. You know, it's out in hardback, $25.99 right now. Why should I be able to download it for free? But, like, that's what I keep searching for, is if I'm going to find it. So anyway, sharing can mean a lot of different things, but it's a really useful way to weave a network together and to strengthen a network. And I was thinking about links as another thing that people share a lot. And that's free, but it really builds a lot of connections. And of course, Twitter gets used for that a lot, and Facebook gets used for that a lot. But it's, you know, a lot of people are really thankful when you share a link with them that is useful information, like an article they like or a resource they can use. So wikis and Wikipedia are a great example of where people share their knowledge to make something greater. Are you all familiar with wikis in general, the concept? Basically, wikis are just web pages that the users can edit. And Wikipedia is the most famous example of that. But a lot of organizations will use wikis internally as well to collaborate on things like developing a document together or a set of documents or policy or keeping track of stuff. Like if you have volunteers who organize stuff and the volunteer changes every year, you can have a wiki where they document what they do so that the new person next year doesn't have to learn it from scratch all over. They can see what the last person did and then they can just keep adding to it. And you develop this collective resource together. Yay, open source software! I'm like a cheerleader about open source software. I love it. That's Tux the Penguin, and he's like the international symbol of open source software. I don't know why.
Linux.
Well, yeah, but he's more and more used generically, like to represent open source. So. But it's true. Tux is really associated with Linux, to be fair, which is an open source operating system like Mac or Windows. And actually, all my computers at home run Linux, and my phone runs an open source operating system too. So more and more people, you know, again, I mentioned last night, you know, when Firefox, the browser, first came out, a lot of people thought that was some cockamamie stuff. I'm going to use a free browser made by a bunch of volunteers. Like, what? I mean, in fact, a lot of people hadn't heard of it, and still the majority of people use Internet Explorer, to be fair, but a smaller, increasingly small majority. but what folks have found is that Firefox is successful because it's made by a lot of people. It builds on the strengths of all the participants who do the coding for it, and it's a fundamentally open platform, so that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of plugins and extensions for Firefox, so that you can get things that translate stuff into, you know, different language that you want, or that add a feature. I know they have a lot of LinkedIn plugins. There's stuff you can get that recognizes open data when you're looking at a web page and pulls it out. So if, like, there's a well-formatted address on a web page, I can click a button and have it added to my address book. That's just, like, a thing that I wanted to plug into Facebook. Everybody's not going to use it. But folks make that for the community. So some of these are more or less popular. And these two on the bottom right, this is Drupal, and that's WordPress. And those are both content management systems on the web. And so that's one area where open source really thrives, is web-based applications. That one on the all the way on the left is OpenOffice, and it's a total replacement for Microsoft Office, the whole suite, and it's free. Okay? It doesn't have every single bell and whistle that Microsoft Office has, but it's free. And you can use it. So
what was that one?
OpenOffice. It's at OpenOffice.org. All right, I need to hurry up so we can have some more time for questions. I won't get into too much of the details of this story, although I love it, but it's a distributed action where some folks were mad at Sinclair Broadcasting Network, and so they nationally organized to make a database of who all the advertisers were on local Sinclair stations, and then they nationally organized to have volunteers call those different stations and complain about the things that they didn't like. And it was successful. It's one of my ancient 2004 examples, so I won't get into it. But people pooled their labor together. Yeah.
Yeah. The what had happened was at the end of each of the broadcasts, the vice president of the company came on with a political commentary that was quite a bit right of center, and we had a local TV station mm-hmm. that had that, and every night there would be a political commentary by this guy.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly he disappeared, but it was because of that.
Yeah, and this particular campaign was about, they had produced a documentary about John Kerry, this was 2004,
right.
Called Stolen Honor. And so this particular campaign was mobilizing against Sinclair just to get them to not show this documentary, basically. And they were successful. They did not air the whole thing in full. And you know, they had a pretty good point. And they, you know, your local paint company advertising on their local Channel 5 probably didn't know that that's what they were supporting. And so it was very effective, this campaign. But it could not have been done by like a national nonprofit just putting staff on it. You never could have paid for all the labor that it took. And it's another example of one of those stories when it's breaking. In fact, I used to have another picture on this slide about how before the Stolen Honor thing came out. See, I am telling you the story anyway, but the blog Daily Coast had already been writing about Sinclair. They knew about them. And so the year before, another thing they had done was one of those news magazine shows on TV that did a thing where they were reading the names of all the fallen soldiers in Iraq, and Sinclair preempted it, so none of their stations would get that part. And so this was something Daily Coast had written about in 2003. And so that was building this narrative so that we collectively, whoever reads it, I actually don't read it that often, but us readers as a concept already have a sense of this, oh, Sinclair, we're not too crazy about them. So then when the Stolen Honor thing comes out, you don't have to say, okay, step one, here's what Sinclair is, this network of, instead they're like, Sinclair's at it again, you know who they are, right? So it's a story that's evolving and developing, but then also when the thing breaks, so they have a network they can use. And they had a blog, Daily Coast, with thousands of people reading it that they could use. Okay, the fifth aspect of your effective network is people actually knowing about that network and also feeling like they're a member of it. And I expect this is really relevant for church groups and stuff. People may or may not know, A, what you're doing, what cool programs you have, and B, even if they do, they may think that's for someone else. It's not a resource for me. It's for somebody else, something like that. So people have to know what it is to participate in it. With the rise of cell phones, something really fun started, of course, in San Francisco, called flash mobs. It's a very San Francisco-y thing, right? Where people would sign up to be on this list, and then they would get a text to their phone that would say, in 1 hour, meet at the intersection of X and Y Street, and at exactly the stroke of 3:05, jump up in the air and yell, huzzah! Right? And then it would be like a big public art happening. People would just show up and just do it, and everyone else is like, what's going on? And then everybody would just disperse. And people still do stuff like that. So these over here on the bottom, these are examples of flash mobs. During the Olympics in China, a lot of people who were organizing to raise the visibility of Tibet wanted to use the torch run as an opportunity to talk about that. And in San Francisco, again, when the torch was going through, the police would block off the route so that protesters couldn't get in the way. And then it would go out through Twitter and other text networks, okay, the police are on this street now, so everybody go to this other street instead. And it was very effective, and they, as you can see, the Olympic torch route changed as a result of their in-the-minute organizing. But you had to have signed up for that network to get those things on your phone in the first place. One of my friends said, you know, what if we did a text network where we got people to say, come down to this public hearing at Town Hall tonight, you know, in 15 minutes, come to Town Hall. You know, could you do, like, come to church, you know, this really cool thing going on today, free ice cream or whatever. Not free beer. We talked about that last night. I decided it's probably not up your alley. And actually worthy of its own, like, hour of discussion is the Twitter revolution in Iran. Do you remember last summer when people, you know, finally said, you know, no, this election's not democratic. We're coming into the street. We demand a more representative government. Iran has a very tight control on the media and on information there. And probably no one would have heard about it if it wasn't for people using Twitter and authorities to get the word out. And not only were people on the ground using Twitter to talk about what was happening and to share videos of what was happening, but then the rest of us could get those and we could spread the word to our networks. And that's how it became global. And that in turn did focus the world's eye on Iran for a little while and said, what is going on here? Wait a minute. What the heck? And, you know, people who were killed in the streets, their stories got out because of this. Otherwise, no one would have known. And unfortunately, nothing has changed in Iran. But anyway, another example from a couple of years ago in Burma, where on the top left you see where, of course, this is close to my heart, where the Buddhist monks were marching against the extremely repressive military junta that's been in power there for 30 years. And I love this picture because these are all the monks in their saffron robes, and these are just regular people who are walking alongside to protect them. And again, these images got out, and people organized around the world, and they had this one on the top is in Portland, and all around the world. I looked on Twitter when I was pulling examples on Flickr, which is a photo sharing service, to find examples of this, and I found pictures from like Dublin and Prague and all over the U.S. People all over had the same message of Free Burma, and then here in Second Life, too, people did the same thing. And they even recreated the symbolism of making a chain. And their avatars wore saffron robes and held signs and stuff like that. So possibly in some ways less powerful to press a button on my computer and have my avatar go do that than putting my body in the street. But at the same time, more broad, more easy to do, and so more people participating in it in some ways, and reaching a different community. A lot of people in Second Life who've come to Second Life don't think of it as a platform for political advocacy until they see stuff like this, and then they start saying, well, "What can I do with this? Actually, you know, what other communities can I form?" And then, of course, Twitter is interesting. When you think about what networks people are a part of on Twitter, each of us makes our own network of who we want to listen to on Twitter, which is really, really neat. But increasingly, because of hashtags, which I don't have a good picture of, but this event has a fantastic hashtag. It's UMR10. So if you tweet about it, you can put pound sign UMR10, and then people who are reading Twitter click on that hashtag, and you can see all the different tweets about it. Really cool. I didn't even know about it until after I talked last night. When I went home and I looked it up, and people were tweeting about my talk. People had posted pictures of me and stuff like that. And then I can share that with my friends. Say, look, this is what I'm doing tonight. This is why I'm in Dallas, you know. Let's just go on anyway. So hashtags are a great example. Self-organized networks and people sharing information the way they want to. We can do different stuff with it. It's a very open format. You can suck in a feed of a hashtag and put that in your sidebar. At my organization where I work, Haystack, we have a widget that shows anybody who mentions the word Haystack, because it's spelled funky, anybody who mentions it on Twitter, it shows up in this little feed there. And so we're like, this is what our community is saying. And they might say, you know, I think Haystack is a bunch of idiots. And we're going to have that up there too. It's scary, but it's real. So again, the five aspects of effective networks, and I'm going to stop there so we can have at least a little bit of discussion. So questions?
I do.
Yeah.
How come I can't find Haystack on Facebook?
It's spelled HASTAC.
I did that.
Okay, we have a group. That's weird. It seems to be on its own little schedule there, my computer. So we have a group on Facebook, and